vacuum on at 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. Vacuum on at 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Zero, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
I'm a full-time teacher, so I'm not able to do as much prep sometimes for these interviews as I would really love. Okay, So I'm going to record. We're going to do the 3-2-1 thing, okay, Grant?
Okay, I'm already taping because I don't.
Okay, well, I'll drop off the one that I tape because we're yapping right now. Okay, here we go. Adam, thanks again so much for being here. Is it okay with you if we just dive right in and start?
Yeah, sure. Let's go.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, yeah. So 3, 2, 1.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is Grant Cameron, and I'm joined by my assistant, Sinead Wellahan, out of Toronto. How are you doing, Sinead?
I'm doing very well, thank you, and I'm very glad to be here. It's a pleasure to meet Adam, and I'm very much looking forward to learning from him today.
Beautiful. We got Adam Apollo on, and we are doing some interviews for Contact in the Desert, and Adam will be speaking there. Adam speaks a lot of places. I'll just read his short bio from his Facebook and then add one thing. Adam Apollo offers Jedi training intensives, advanced leadership training, public speaking on cutting edge technology and the future of humanity, and is also a DJ and a performer. And just before we started here, we were talking about ancient archaeology. And so I think we're going to go into that. But how are you doing, Adam?
Doing fantastic, Grant. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, thanks for being on. And we've been on a couple of shows together. And you've done a lot of lecturing around the world, a lot of stuff. Can you maybe get into the background? I heard a couple of interviews you did where you talked about your awakening. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you got into this very bizarre world of that we all sort of share, this, you know, spiritual, paranormal world?
Yeah, absolutely. So as a teenager, I was pretty disgruntled and unhappy with the paradigm of education that I was embroiled in, which led me to do some of my own experimentation and study. And in that process, I discovered that I have this human energy body, and that triggered a whole process of awakening inside of me that really sent me down the rabbit hole of exploring physics in particular, because I wanted to understand why, if I could create a conscious field around my body, if I could poke somebody on the other side of the room with this field and they could feel it, and everybody's had the experience of, you know, feeling the tingle when somebody's looking at you from across the room, and that this is embedded in martial arts over thousands and thousands of years as chi, you know, or ki. It's embedded in Hinduism and other cultures as prana or vital force. And I wanted to know why science didn't have a name for this. Why wasn't this not being taught in the fields of study that I was going through in school? And that led me on a deep dive into unified physics, studying quantum gravity physics from Lee Smolin, string theory, special and general relativity, quantum mechanics. And as I went deeper down that rabbit hole, I started to really see that there is this sort of underlying field to everything that's been known about for thousands of years, even in science and physics. It used to be called the ether, but that it was wiped out at the turn of the 1900s. And I realized that now is the time to kind of reincorporate this knowledge. And so I became a very outspoken speaker, not only on transforming education, but on transforming science, our understandings in physics, and where those can lead us in the future. So that got me invited to speak at the White House, the United Nations. I did a bunch of conferences and festivals around the world. And then in 2005, I ended up having an extraterrestrial contact experience that absolutely changed my perspective on everything and upgraded the level of my knowledge a little bit more to the sense of not only our planetary journey, but the galactic journey that we're a part of.
Okay, now I need to know what you're speaking on contact in the desert, but first I got a question before I forget, based upon what you just said. You had an awakening, I had an awakening, Sinead had an awakening. Why is it that you, I, and Sinead wake up and vast majority of people, maybe 95% of people, remain asleep? Is there something that you have figured out about that?
You know, I think that a lot of people don't ask the hardest questions, or if they do, they keep them to themselves. I had the benefit of having a close friend. His name is Christopher Oriana, and he's someone that I dialogued with about these questions that didn't have answers. You know, how is it that you feel it when someone's looking at you? How can you think of someone and they call you on the phone? How is it possible that some of these people are able to do these amazing feats of walking on coals and things like that? And by having a friend to investigate into those issues with, I think it opened up my mind a little bit more. It softened the edges of my belief system so that I would be open to something else being possible, because the existing answers I had just simply didn't cut it. So I figured, you know, if I asked the right questions, and through asking the right questions, it led me to the right experiences to wake up. I think that's something that anybody can do. The problem is when we grip our belief system, when we think that what we know has to be the truth and attach some sense of safety to that truth, that's when we really need to let go and open up and try something new. The other thing that I'll say, Grant, on this topic is that I think that foundationally, the experience of the human energy body, of chi and ki, regardless of who you are, the first time you have that experience, it's going to unlock something inside of you. The first time you feel that field of charge, and you could do that whether you're going to a Tai Chi class to learn that, you know, Kundalini yoga to feel the charge inside of your body, or you have the opportunity to meet somebody like me, you know, who will just create a thread between their hands and let you actually feel what that feels like, because it's so obvious and it's so direct when you experience it, and yet it's completely absent from our popular culture understanding and our schools. So that kind of thing is a great key that will, you know, open the door to a whole new layer of understanding for people.
Adam, let me ask you about the education system. Sorry, Grant, I have to ask him a question now about education, because I'm a public school teacher, and you know, there are many, 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 many teachers out there, and we have a very entrenched school system that operates a very specific way, right? Whether it's in the US or Canada, our systems are very similar. I think you're American, Grant and I are Canadian. What do you think of the way this school system is organized? You referenced a few minutes ago your own experience in public education, which I relate to. So just thinking about how education, public education specifically, is structured, and how that system is structured, and how, you know, education is supposed to be about critical thinking, it's supposed to be about awareness and knowledge and understanding. Can you speak to that a little bit in terms of what you just said? I'm really curious your thoughts on that.
Sure, absolutely. You know, I will say, just as a framework for those that may be in the education sector, you know, it sounds like you work in schools. I understand that our current format for education is one that was developed over time, and we've done the best we could so far, right, with the knowledge that we had so far. And the idea was simply that, you know, you take people who have developed a certain understanding in a certain area or a certain theory for so long, and you put them in front of others that haven't, and you have them lecture to them and give them a book, and there's a standardized curriculum, and the kids are supposed to just absorb that and memorize it and know it, and then that's supposed to make them more proficient citizens. Now, you know, this can work in some cases, right, in certain specific fields. It can be helpful to develop that memorization. You know, if you're a doctor, it's really good to know all the terms for all in all the Latin for, you know, the different diseases and for the different parts of our anatomy and biology. There is memorization involved in a lot of fields. However, the act of learning itself and education itself is not something that occurs through memorization. It's something that occurs through internal inquiry and discovery. When we truly want to learn or discover something, we have to ask a question inside of us, something that we actually really want to know. And when we actually really want to know something, then we can seek out the resources that can give us that knowledge and those answers. And I think we're missing a huge part of that inquiry process in school, you know, having the conversations that naturally, you know, Aristotle style arise the questions within us that we actually are actively curious about, that then the teacher can guide us to an understanding through. Now, the other thing is that we, I think, specialize a little bit too much. We get caught up in single branches of study or knowledge. And as we go down certain specialization pipelines, we start to lose perspective on other fields and other ways of looking at things. I was just doing an interview at Gaia with Robert Grant for his show called The Codex, and he was asking me about what makes a polymath different. And one of the things that I like to say about polymaths and people like that is that they're not looking at things just through a math lens. They're looking at the underlying fields. They're looking for the patterns in different things. And by looking for the underlying pattern, they can find that pattern in music. They can find it in math. They can find it in physics. They can find it in architecture. You can find it anywhere. And that's a powerful way to learn. And I think mastery really happens when we learn how to apply different lenses and different points of views on a subject that's not just from the one field we may be coming from, but from all the different sides. You know, a master fisherman doesn't just talk about the ocean in terms of sails and the rudders. He can talk about the ocean poetically and in the depth of its relationship to all of life. And that shows mastery.
Yeah, I mean, interconnectedness, right? We can't isolate these topics. They all connect to each other. Everything connects to everything else, which of course brings us to another one of your topics of interest, which is consciousness. And I believe Grant might have had a question, so I just want to give him a second to pop in if he needs to. But I really would love to hear your take on how consciousness comes into play in terms of all the different things that you're working on, because of course that is the crux of it all, really. That's our opinion anyway, Grant's and mine, that it's really all about consciousness. So given that you seem to share that opinion, I'm very interested to hear what you have to say on that. But Grant, do you want to pop in? Is there anything you want to ask?
I'll sort of lead into your question by describing, I worked at a university for almost 40 years. I wasn't a professor, but I was around academics. I talked to academics, stuff like that. And the way I describe it, you were just mentioning, the way I describe it is that there's a difference between describing and knowing. Science will say, we explain this, we explain that. And I go, no, you're just describing. You're describing a process. And what happens at university is when I always say, you think that they're here to learn stuff. They're not here to learn stuff. They're here to basically get their degree. And whatever the professor tells them, that's what's on the test. It's not like at the end of the test, you suddenly discover that Christopher Columbus was born in a different city than he was, and you're going to go back and change your grade. They're not going to change your grade. You put down what the guy wants. And the minute they get their degree, they will never darken the door of the university ever again. They got what they want. They answer the questions. So it's this idea of the difference between describing what you're seeing around you and this idea of knowing. And it gets into this thing of the consciousness field. Do you understand that there is a consciousness field where the answers are, or that you may even in, say, if it's a multiple life world, you may actually be guiding yourself to awaken yourself to direct you towards certain things? Is there a field where all the material is? And is that what we're doing in terms of awakening, where we're tapping into something, whereas these people are just sort of watching, sitting on the sidelines and watching?
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent question. And it connects right back to what I was talking about as far as the missing component in physics, which is this underlying field called the ether, or what we commonly now refer to as quantum vacuum fluctuations. Now, there's something very fascinating that arises as we begin to study this area of this vacuum energy, this quantum field. And that is that it has very specific properties which relate to the way that consciousness appears to operate. One of those properties being holographic properties. In other words, within the field of the fabric of space itself, if you get down to the Planck scale and you start looking at like, what is this whole thing made of? Like, what is space-time made of? The best quantum gravity theories suggest that space-time's not empty with the little floating balls moving around in it, but that it in fact is a geometric structural lattice that is woven together and just happens to have superfluid properties, properties of tensegrity, as Buckminster Fuller would put it. And because it's made of light, in other words, the Planck scale vibrations are really just the highest frequencies of light that are possible without that light collapsing in on itself and forming a singularity, they're at that threshold, then what happens is light is this field that we're embedded within. And everything that we see, everything that's made is made of light. And light has these very interesting properties when you look at interference patterns. So an interference pattern of light can store information and data within it that can be reproduced by other lights simply by matching the interference patterns or matching the vibrational patterns. We've got, you know, scientists at the top level postulating that entanglement is actually due to an interference pattern matching another interference pattern in another location, or one vibrational pattern in space-time matching another. And that this, in fact, is the nature of entanglement, is that quantum coherence, that shared vibration between two points in space. So this suggests to us that if the entire universe operates this way, well, of course, consciousness operates this way. Consciousness is non-local because it's literally engaging with and embedded with this quantum vacuum holographic fabric that's able to receive and transmit non-local information to different places at different times. Now, if you look at that from the standpoint of a timeline, a linear timeline, then you begin to see that certain locations and certain experiences in certain places may have encoded certain information into that quantum vacuum fabric. And no matter when it happens, sometime later down the line, now, let's say, you get into the same sort of vibrational field as existed during the experience in that prior time. And all of a sudden, it's like a library opens up and you now have accessibility to the information that was encrypted during the experiences in that place and time. Everybody's had this experience. You experience it when you go to a place and where some major event in history happened. You'll have tourists walking around in Rome by the Colosseum, and every once in a while, somebody gets chills because they literally can feel the intensity of what it was like when people were battling inside that Colosseum. Now, based on your other layer of questioning, which is around, you know, the possibility of past life recall, well, absolutely. If you go to a place where you've had a very intense experience in another time in another body, is it possible for that information and the emotion and the energy to transmit to now for you to experience it again? And perhaps in an even deeper way, I would say absolutely. And I'd say that's part of our human nature, is actually tying together the threads of the pieces of our experience that we've left in the past.
Oh, okay, let me ask the other, because Sinead's shut off here. Let's go a little bit farther. Sinead and I did an interview just recently about the simulation theory. With one of the experts on simulation theory. Can you talk about simulation theory and some of the other concepts that are really advanced now that move into the whole idea? For example, Donald Hoffman, who says everything inside the physical world is just an icon on the desktop, that you can never, ever get to actual reality, that at all, or even Deepak Chopra goes even farther to say Everything is an activity inside consciousness, including mathematics, space-time. It's all an activity inside consciousness. Have you spoken about that or researched the whole simulation idea that there may not even be a physical world or time or space, that it's all a reality that we can't even describe?
Certainly. Being a tech person, I deal with simulations all the time, and I'm rendering, 3D objects and 3D spaces and witnessing people's interactivity with games and other kinds of simulations. It's certainly a fascinating approach to look at the entire universe and say, maybe perhaps this is all just some computed simulation, and we're all just participating in this sort of virtual reality game. But ontologically, there are some problems with that theory and that approach. Ontologically, you cannot actually discern the difference. In other words, if it is all a simulated reality and it is all virtual, and certainly we see, similarities in things like the quantum states that form, the structure of space with, binary states we see within a computer, and then the quantum computer states being able to render even more advanced information constructs. Certainly we see connections between where AI is going, supposed AI, with the way that consciousness actually operates. But I would say that there's no such thing as artificial intelligence. In other words, intelligence and consciousness are built into the fabric of space-time itself. The entire system of the universe, while you could operate, you could say it has an analog operation that's similar to a simulation. If you can't tell the difference, then there's no real purpose in calling it a simulation, because you're inherently at a limit of possible experience as long as you're perceiving things as if, it's being controlled by some other force or some other source, and you're just playing along in this game. There's a great deal of power that comes with the awareness that, yes, there is an underlying sort of matrix or patterning to the universe that we're in. That underlying pattern teaches us about ourselves. It shows us synchronicities. It shows us incredible things, like when we look at the radius of the sun and the radius of the earth and the radius of the moon and Jupiter, and we start realizing that there's number patterns encrypted in the scale and the size of the planets, that relate to deeply fundamental geometric concepts, and that these things are somehow so connected that it's, we just had a lunar eclipse, and it's just astounding that somehow, the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun, from the perspective of the earth, and the sun's 400 times further away. So it's exactly the right size, so that lines up so that the earth's shadow can block out the moon. These things are not coincidences. They are part of a deeper patterning, but the patterning itself, I think, we take away from it when we believe that it's just a simulation. And the unlimited capacity of consciousness shows us that, yes, in fact, sure, the universe is generated and consciousness is generating that universe. And yet we have will in the space and the structure of how that universe unfolds. We can feel it when we're in higher states of consciousness, that we play a deep role in how everything that we perceive occurs. And we can change it, we can modify it, we can interact with it. And sure, it is like a big game, but it's not a big game necessarily going on in the computer box of some higher civilization. I think that limits us in a great way. Whereas if we see it's a great game we're all participating in as conscious observers, and able to change and modify that game as desired, it's much more empowering.
Yeah, I think I agree with you that some people make the simulation and then it comes down to who's creating the simulation. So my question, I guess, would be, the whole idea is consciousness primary. Does consciousness cause time-space, or does time-space evolve consciousness? And to me, it would be consciousness is primary, and everything is like the one quantum physicist guy said, it's all ooey stuff. It's all built from this consciousness. So can you describe your impression of the basics of the universe, like consciousness, how you describe it and how it develops the world that we are familiar with?
Absolutely. So I agree with you. Consciousness is a priori. It exists before. It's the start and the journey and the end. Consciousness is there no matter what. And consciousness can be looked at through a variety of lenses, one of which I think is extremely valuable to look at in relationship to the universe that we experience. And that's from the lens of what I like to call the ray of creation. So if you look at everything as starting in a void or emptiness, the zero, and then you witness the sort of emergence of the one from the zero, and you realize that the zero is actually a circle. So it is actually the first thing already. The first thing and the nothing exists sort of simultaneously. And they're both infinite. They're both eternal. There's infinite nothingness or infinite everything in one thing. And they're the same thing. And then from there, we began to see the dynamics of consciousness really come out. When we look at the one becoming the two, we end up with duality, positive and negative charge, gender, masculine, feminine force, hot and cold, thermodynamics. Literally everything starts to issue forth from the balance between the thing that was and the thing that is, or the two things that emerge, you know, that first split of time, the creation of time in the beginning of the universe. And the dynamics get more rich from there, because every time you have a balance, a duality, you also have a balance point between the two. And that is the Trinity. The Trinity encompasses the duality and yet is separate and a transcendent on its own. And then as you begin to see the transcendent become a part of the weave, a part of the dynamics, now you've got four and you've got space and you've got this dynamic of the tetrahedron and the ability for three-dimensional space to occur. Each of these steps as we go, and you can continue from there to the 5, 6, 7, and some of my other presentations deeply focus on this for those that are interested. It's looking at literally step by step the dynamics of consciousness, learning how to perceive itself. And there's a few fundamental principles to that that roll across the whole thing. One of those being the nature of the transcendent. Anytime you have a set of anything, you always have a dynamic between those things. And you can look at those things as a whole in themselves, and you can transcend those things and see those things from a higher perspective. Meaning that, you know, for example, if we take fire, air, earth, and water, they're elements. Nowadays, we call it thermodynamics, aerodynamics, hydrodynamics, geodynamics, right? We have different names for basically the study of the same thing, but inherent to those and embedded in those, there's always been spirit, right? And the spirit point in many different traditions or religions really could be looked at as what is the structure in space-time that's transcendent to that which creates heat or fire, to that which creates the properties of air and wind. And so we have to look deeper basically than those molecular structures and patterns. And we begin to see that it's actually an energy in space-time, right? The actual quantum field that's changing, that's giving rise to these perceptions. And so the study of spirit or ether dynamics, as we might call it, you know, can show us a deeper level of what's really going on. And consciousness operates in this way. We get stuck in one series of patterns or one series of objects or another, but we always grow and we always learn when we're willing to actually step outside of the field where we're studying and actually look at all of the pieces of that field as a spectrum, as elements in a higher system. And we can do that over and over again. And it's also important we learn how to descend down to understand the details of each element or each process.
Okay, now let me ask you, I wrote a book called Contact Modalities, and Sinead had hers, I had a couple of different ones. And you talked about your experience of having suddenly interactions with beings that aren't us. So did you choose that? Did they choose you? And it goes back to this question about whether we're getting help. Like Adam got help on his test. These beings told him what's going on. They told him the answers. Whereas most people don't get the answers. So how do you explain the contact modality that you had in terms of dealing with extraterrestrial races? Is that you planning that? Is that part of your mission on Earth, or how did this happen that they would give you, and what did they give you in terms of understanding that has helped you where you have gotten today?
You know, they say that a fertile mind is able to grow many things. And one of the things that I've cultivated in my life is the fertile mind. And the answer to your question is really two-sided. One is that in the process of coming to a place where I was able to make contact in that way, I had to go through a sequence of healings and memory and reclaim parts of myself that already had certain information. And that primed me, that created the sort of fertile space as I composted all this pain and these shadows and these challenges through time for the communication that I was going to have with these galactic beings to be possible, to be clear, to be coherent, for me to be able to actually translate and understand what they were communicating to me in a way that I could actually apply in my life and teach others. I don't think that happens for everybody. Some people, I think it's like, you know, you get a lightning bolt, they get a strike, they have a visitation at night, and they have no idea how to explain what just happened. And so for me, I think I both prepared myself for the moment of when that experience would happen by creating the space within me and studying the fields of knowledge that I needed to study to be able to understand these beings and understand myself as one of them. And that's the really big threshold, is that I came into awareness that I was not from this planet. I remembered choosing to come here from the Sirian star system and looking at Earth as the ice age was coming in and all of these peoples were being kind of shoved together. And there was this heightened civilization going on this beautiful, you know, rich, biologically diverse garden planet. And I was making a choice with a bunch of other beings to go in and incarnate as humans or as hybrid humans from some of our ancestors that had already come down and helped develop additional genetic lines on the planet, to choose to come here and actually celebrate and participate with humanity the sort of reunion with the rest of the consciousness around the galaxy, the reconnection of the people of this Earth with the amazing beings that are all over the galaxy. And so I was in the state of being prepared because I was coming into awareness of who I truly am and what my journey has been and why I'm here. And I think that was critical to signaling them to say, he's ready and let's go down and make sure. And my first physical contact experience with this being was really a test. She was trying to figure out, was I really ready? And how was I going to do? Was I going to judge humanity from this new galactic perspective and look at these redneck guys as less than me? Or was I going to embrace them and honor the journey of consciousness for humanity on the planet and hold space, no matter how dark and how bad it looks? Could I hold space for wherever humanity is at and continue holding the torch to see us through in this transition of our adolescence, coming into the point where we get our driver's license, so to speak, and are able to actually get out there in a spaceship and travel around the galaxy and start integrating with these other galactic cultures?
Okay, now that leads to two questions. The one is, do you teach that? Are you able to teach that? Because when you go to UFO events or C5 events, everybody goes, yeah, I'd love to talk to an alien. Oh, man, I just like, how come these guys get it and I don't get to have talk to an alien? Are you able to teach this? Do you do this teaching? And answer that, and then I'll try to remember what my second question was.
Sure, I do. I'm very careful and selective about when and where and with whom I teach that knowledge. I think that it's important to get a really strong foundation before you go there. And that's why I teach unified physics. That's why I have the Guardian Alliance, which is my self-mastery and self-development school. It's important to sort of break the ground that's hardened and soften the soil of the mind that's going to go to that next level and that next step. have I called in ships for people to have experiences with them and have their first real visibility of that? Absolutely. Many, many, many times. I just did it recently in Sedona for a friend of mine who actually was the guy who brought me to the White House and got me as a speaker there. And he had in all of these years still not actually had an experience of seeing ships. And so I decided to drop in with him and call in some ships and took about 5 minutes. And it was just right when he was like giving up and kind of like, oh, you know, I love you anyway, Adam. You know, it was right then that the ship showed up and there was five or six of them that came into the atmosphere, got really bright and then shot up and out of the atmosphere again. Super brilliantly clear night. And it was a fantastic first step for him. And what I told him is something that I would tell anybody who does this work, who sees a ship, is that that's the first step. The next step is actually opening yourself up to communication, learning how to quiet the mind enough to transmit information and receive information. And this is training in telepathy. This is not just training in like, you know, how to relate with an extraterrestrial species. It's training in how to enable yourself to be able to receive communication at a higher level, because these species are extremely proficient at telepathy. It's the only way they can communicate across star systems faster than light. And so they expect that to be a part of our process in growth and development, to be able to kind of meet them at the cultural level that they operate at.
Can I ask you, what was the reaction at the White House? And second, how do you hold space in what most people would consider to be a total mess of whatever is going on now? Do you follow the news? How do you keep that space? And what was the reaction at the White House when you talked to the people there?
Yeah, so my mission at the White House was to, in an undercover way, meaning subtly, find some of these youth philanthropists and kids from some of the wealthiest families in the world were there, and a lot of kids leading NGOs. We're all in our early 20s. And a lot of them, you know, were curious about a lot of things and traveled around the world. And my job was subtly to kind of figure out who of them were interested in new energy systems, the future of humanity, starship technologies, new energy technologies, et cetera. And so that was kind of my undercover mission within the space. And my front in the space was to represent myself as a youth education ambassador, to talk about my work and experiences in education. I was also working with a group called Campaign 2020, assessing, you know, what are the kinds of major changes needed to achieve a sustainable planet by the year 2020. Of course, that project and that campaign fell apart, but a lot of the keys that we were developing in those times are still highly relevant today. And a lot of those processes are things that we're doing today to try to curb climate change and help the planet in different ways. So in terms of my work at the White House, I was able to make, I think, a pretty significant impact in the space of talking about Town Square 2.0, the next level of where we need to go and how communities need to come together and how education can be decentralized in a sense and given back to the power of the people. And there can be new processes and ways that we learn and grow together. And then on the sort of secret mission side, that was also successful because I met a woman who the following year, when I was at the United Nations speaking, was able to introduce her to Nissim Haramein and able to secure him a substantial amount of funding to set up new labs and begin doing energy system development on Kauai. And so I'd say I had some fair success on both angles of that. Now, remind me your second question.
Do you watch the news? How do you hold space in what's going on in today that most people would see?
Let's just say I keep track of the news. I keep track of the news and I pay attention to what's being communicated and what's going on. I find that it's very difficult for me to actually sit down and watch an entire news broadcast. And the reason is because the amount of agenda and sort of pre-structuring to the communication format and programming at this point in my development, it's so glaringly obvious. I feel like if I sit there and I'm just listening and absorbing, I'm literally just being manipulated into a certain thought pattern. And you definitely find that, especially when you look into the political space, you look into people's perceptions of the vaccine, people's perceptions of COVID, they tend to regurgitate that which has become their fundamental belief about those things, which oftentimes is not actually from scientific papers. In fact, most of the time it's not. It's not from scientific papers. It's not from actual studies. It's not from looking at lawsuits against the companies releasing vaccines. It's not from any actual deep inquiry and study. It's from repeating and regurgitating that which is said to be the truth and what we need to know, which is what the news is giving us. Now, I know enough these days to know that, you know, there's a lot of financial interests behind a lot of what we see on the news. And there's a lot of shaping to production. You know, you'll see it all the way down at the smallest production houses, is that the agenda of the director can really shape the story of how something comes out and how the public is going to perceive it. I think it's extremely dangerous, the situation that we're in many cases, though, where a lot of the mass media and the news is vastly distorted. And the alternatives that we have are not much better, because we don't know how to trust where we're getting the information. The sources are missing a lot of times. So people go to look for alternative news. And the next thing you know, the alternative news is a whole nother area where clickbait and blasts and financial interests are trying to drive and manipulate people towards certain marketing interests or buying certain products or whatever. So it's really a minefield out there. And that's a lot of the reason for my work now in building decentralized social technologies and trust systems to enable us to better track information sources, the identities where information comes from, and be able to fight a lot of this issue around fake news and the noise factor that's out there.
Okay. Sinead?
Yeah, Adam, I'm relating so much to what you're saying, and I want to ask you a question based on what you were just talking about with regard to, you know, media influence and information, or what is not information out there, and how difficult that is for all of us to kind of wade through and try to make sense of right now. I agree with you. It does really feel like a minefield in many different ways. So my question for you is, this is also kind of alluding to what you were saying about feeling like you're not really from here. I think that's something that a lot of people in this field, you know, we all know, a lot of people in this field relate to that also, that feeling of like, why am I here? None of these things make sense, or, you know, aspects of human behavior or human thought or patterns of how we operate in the systems we've created for ourselves. You know, these don't make sense to me, and it's confusing and it can be stressful. So there's so much stimulation that's out there. There's so much sensory stimulation. There's so much intellectual stimulation, both good and bad. And, you know, I don't like using the words good and bad, but you know what I'm saying. So in terms of the overwhelming extrasensory environment that we find ourselves in, which could be because of this planet, could be because of this dimension, something that Grant and I hear over and over again is that, you know, and we believe this also, that it all comes down to the individual mindset that you choose to have, right? The personal work you do on yourself. And you were talking about that a bit earlier, how you couldn't have gotten to where you are now without having set the stage for yourself through doing a lot of personal work. So if we bring it back to that touch point, you know, in contrast, like the individual person, the individual mindset, and what we're doing personally to work on our consciousness and our own personal development, in contrast to that, you know, tidal wave of external stimulation and extrasensory stimulation around us, how do you personally keep yourself, I don't want to say protected, because that's also, I have a little bit of an aversion to that work, that's also creating the illusion of separateness, like this us and them thing, you know, I have to protect myself from them. But how do you create a space for yourself in your own life where you're able to stay grounded in what you know and stay grounded in what you believe and, you know, stay on your path in a really firm way so that you can continue, as you said, carrying the torch to do the work that you want to do here on this planet? How do you keep yourself in the zone?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying that I'm not perfect, and nobody is. And, you know, we all experience, I don't care, you know, who you are, how amazing the guy is, the speaker is, or the teacher that you're learning from. Everyone deals with periods of challenge where that information can be overwhelming. We can be deeply impacted emotionally. We can go through major grieving cycles. And I think those are essential. It's essential for us to process some of that feeling and to sometimes feel confused and not sure what the answer is. I've had a lot of those moments over the last couple of years, particularly in, you know, seeing some of my closest friends get so extremely confused by the information that they were being given, and sensing sort of the field around them and realizing that we were getting to such a point in time where even just questioning alternative sources of information that were coming through to some of my friends and others around me was a volatile space. All I had to do was ask a question of like, well, how does it make sense if A is true that B is true? And I'd have people go, are you kidding me? You must be part of the dark cabal and evil and whatever, just because I was questioning an assumption that I heard and I didn't have data to back it up. I'd look for the data. I couldn't find it. And I questioned assumptions.
Yeah. This is one of the things I was thinking of when you mentioned minefields. It's just conversations with people these days. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. And so it becomes a very delicate situation because the peer pressure is there. It's a different kind of peer pressure. It's the peer pressure of if you speak out against something like this, you know, how are you going to be attacked? Right. And so people start getting quieter and they start not standing out or speaking out against or asking certain questions because of the potential danger to them. I have a lifetime where I remember being alive in Germany during the rise of Hitler. And I can tell you how terrifying that was, because just realizing that if you question certain things or you go certain directions, you are going to be dead. It was a very, very strong encouragement to play along with the scenario and to go along with whatever the popular culture was, you know, going along in their belief system around. And that is exceptionally challenging and dangerous space for us to be in as a society and culture, when even alternative ideas become so cultish that we begin shaming those that don't believe the same thing, or believing others are crazy or stupid, you know, because they have a different understanding or a different knowledge base. I think we're in a place now where it's essential to be able to step back, to take the space, to find in ourselves what feels right and what feels true, to ask the right questions, to find a few close friends that we can actually talk about these things with and explore these issues and weigh the positives and the negatives of different viewpoints. And to just recognize that, yeah, a lot of the stuff out there is noise, and we do have to be very cautious about how much we let all of that information drive us on the inside versus how much are we driving and how much are we connected to the truth within and actually steering our way through the mess. A lot of the deepest places where people face confusion are simply small misinterpretations of really critical ideas. If we look at, for example, the sort of phenomena of the flat earth movement as a great example, this is one I, you know, don't speak to that often, but I like to point to it because, first of all, there is absolutely a relevance to understanding dimensionality, to understanding the perspective of the point, the line, the plane, the sphere, and so on and so forth. It's dimensional progression. But a lot of the cases, and, you know, I could go down a list of 100 things debunking the whole idea of a flat earth. It's pretty easy to do if you understand some basic science and perspective. But, you know, one of those things is simply the way that perception of light operates. We don't necessarily, I think, have a very clear collective perception, conception of how light travels and how our point of view changes the way that light looks coming from different directions. If you've ever stood out in the rain, this is a really fun one that a lot of people probably have had the experience of. You stood out in the rain and you've looked at the reflection of a street light on the wet ground, right? It looks like all the rain is going radially towards that point of light, right? It looks like this whole spherical field as if the raindrops are somehow moving towards the center of the light, but it's actually just the way the light is refracting and moving through the raindrops. So, for example, the idea that just because the sun is huge and far away, that all of its light rays are going to enter the atmosphere in straight lines, mm-hmm. you know, and that like all the shadows of the clouds should go straight down mm-hmm. and all of that is missing the fact that you're looking at a cone of light. And so because your perception is determining the angle that you're looking at light from, now you can start to see why clouds and shadow arrays and all of these different atmospheric phenomena occur that actually further explain the relationship between the Earth and Sun. If you can ask the right questions and look at it the right way, instead of just being like, oh my God, you're right, that's weird. That must just disprove this idea or that idea, you know, and just jump to a conclusion. The other one, of course, being like, you know, imagine every single pilot, and I have a lot of friends and family who have pilots, you know, imagine every pilot on Earth being part of a conspiracy that they're all deciding to turn slightly, you know, as they're flying their airplanes. You know, and every astronaut is lying and every person who works at NASA is lying. Is it easier to believe that all of those people are lying all the time, keeping up this facade, mm-hmm. you know, or just question the idea that, well, maybe, you know, maybe NASA lies about some things, but probably not about something that's been known for thousands of years that can be proved in countless ways. It's like unpacking and detangling the conspiracy theories. That's the real challenge, because there's usually a seed of truth somewhere in there, right? There's something we need to learn from it, but they get super tangled up because of just mixed messages, belief systems, and jumping on a bandwagon of one idea or another just because we don't understand it.
I mean, I have to say it is fascinating and, you know, obvious also to me anyway, and anybody who's in education and also things like this, the convergence of the decline of the quality of the education system. I mean, it is definitely not as holistic as it used to be. And I know that might make me sound like I'm saying, oh, you know, the good old days. It was never a perfect system. There is no perfect system. But I definitely had the experience of, you know, being a student and now being a teacher in the public school system. Being a student, I remember learning quite a bit of critical thinking and, you know, being allowed to be curious, being allowed to be playful. There's not as much space and time for that anymore. It's a very different kind of system now. So there's this convergence of the quality of the education system in terms of critical thinking, questioning, curiosity, you know, freedom to play with ideas. As that is going down, so are all these conspiracy theories and the cynicism that people have about the systems that we're operating in. And so I do think that there is a legitimacy, I agree with you, to the feeling that people have that makes them attracted to the conspiracy theories, because we all know something's up. Right. We all know that something is up, and we may not be informed enough to know why or what is happening, but we can have a sense, you know, we're all connected to each other. There's the energy field that we all belong to. We all feel that. And so, you know, everyone knows something is up right now. And so, you know, of course, there are things that are so inherently important as we go through this process. And you keep mentioning education, which I really, really love, because I do think that it's promising and it's exciting that there are these new schools such as your own that are popping up around the world that are teaching people to think differently, teaching them how to interact with our reality differently, and to take it beyond how we've ever thought before and how we've ever, you know, chosen to operate before. And I think that's really, really exciting. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the work that you're doing at the Guardian Academy, maybe at the Resonance Academy also. I'm not sure if you started it or if you're a faculty member there, if you were invited to come. I should know that. I apologize, but maybe you can talk a bit more about, you know, the work that you're doing in terms of furthering or advancing the progress of education to where it more needs to be, because it's certainly true that education worldwide is not matching where, you know, this phase that we're all in right now in terms of pushing through something into a new phase of development, right? The education system is far, far, far behind that. So the work you're doing is not. And if you could talk to that for a minute, that would be wonderful.
Sure. Thanks. When I spoke about connecting Nassim Harman with a funder at the UN, shortly after that happened and those funds actually came through to him, I had basically figured out the puzzle pieces of what I needed to build a learning management system, a highly integrated online academy framework and structure. Didn't have the funding to do it. So I actually reached out to the board of directors of the Resonance Science Foundation, or Resonance Project as it was at the time. And Marshall Efforts and Teresa Collins met with me, and I gave them my idea. And I said, look, I want to build this new education system, and I'd love to build the first academy for the Resonance Project, because there's tons of people interested in this stuff, but they're not able to kind of go through and really learn it all. And there's like these little small groups and pods of delegates and emissaries as they had that had been on trips with Nassim. And I thought, well, maybe this can also build the financial groundwork for this profit so that it's not always just going out and having to raise more money too. So I went about with Teresa and Marshall. They wanted to join me, and we founded a company called Superluminal Systems, which I brought in my other super Jedi, amazing programmer friend, who I still work with now, and we still are building these new systems together. And we built the Resonance Academy for Unified Physics. It worked out really well because I also teach physics, and this is a deep area of my study and my work. And so I was able to integrate a lot of my own ideas and thinking into that academy. The free Unified Science course that anyone who's watching this can take, if you go to resonancescience.org, you can take the free Unified Science course. I wrote modules 3 and 4 in that sequence and series. Module 3 being all of my work connecting the story of physics from Descartes to the unified physics of quantum gravity. And then module 4 being my translation of and co-editing work with Nassim on a lot of his papers and work to explain his perspective in unified physics and help people really grasp it at a deep and foundational level. So that was sort of my doctorate thesis, was to provide this full lens of how we get from the physics that most people know and understand and have studied to the unified physics perspective and why the shift is so important. And you know, it's an online course. It's designed to go at your own pace. It's built with forums around it for people to ask questions. Teachers can come in and learn and study from those forums. The technical architecture of that academy has pretty much completely been redone since then. The whole platform's not even on the system that I built anymore, because it's been many, many, many years. But the formulas that myself and Teresa and Marshall and Harlan created are still baked into the depth of the way that people go in and learn, as well as the faculty courses. And I have my own faculty course on quantum geometry within that academy. That's a real deep dive into the connections between sacred geometry and the structure of the proton itself. So how matter actually forms is related to these incredible geometric principles, which go back thousands and thousands of years in history. It's like right there. It's all embedded inside of this stuff. So that's my work in the physics space. And then the Guardian Alliance was my second academy. And within that school, I decided to apply the same principles, but in a new way, by looking at people's inherent and natural skills and abilities as sort of harmonics within a spectrum. You could think of it as like each person has different superpowers, and the chakras are good models for that. So if someone's got a root chakra superpower, they're in their body, they're physically strong. I call that the warrior archetype. You know, whereas if their heart chakra is super powerful, usually they have healing abilities. They resolve conflicts between people in relationship. And I call that the healer archetype. The ambassador, for example, is throat chakra, you know, is able to speak their truth and change the world through the way that they transmit information. And so the journey through the Guardian Alliance is really about integrating all the different facets of yourself, learning your superpowers and also learning where you're weak and learning how to balance that out by actually looking at things from different perspectives, the perspective of each chakra, as we might say. And that I think is a mastery pathway that I think is critical to the future of all education. What I'm doing now is I've taken the lessons I've learned from these academy prototypes and I'm building them into a much larger system that automates these kinds of processes and gives the ability for anybody to create course content and to create content that can become learning content. And the way that it elevates to that level is through organizational accreditation and trust. So if someone creates a really amazing course on something, you can submit it to, you know, a series of universities or groups or people with PhDs. You can get them to give their seal of approval or trust on it. And that builds this accreditation link so that people taking the course actually know that it's a value. It's sort of ratified. It's got credibility to it. But I want to decentralize that. I don't want it to just come through me and my faculty and friends. And it's great that Khan Academy is this amazing system with all this great learning. I love what they're doing. And it's centralized. You know, Mind Valley is doing amazing stuff and they're centralized. And I think that the real power to get to the truth is going to come when we decentralize and we start leveraging trust and credibility and different things like that to actually organize our global learning process.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. I mean, it's a time more than ever, perhaps, to work in collaboration with each other. And there's so much going on with our wonderful planet. We're doing a great deal of damage to it. And of course, that's going to not benefit us either. So yeah, it's certainly a time to come together in so many different ways. So I love that vision. That's very exciting. And Grant, would you like to pop in?
Yeah, we're sort of over our time, but I didn't want to end before I sort of ask Adam, what he thinks of the present UFO circus going on. I mean, it's a completely different time than it has been. I've never heard you comment on it, whatever you think about what's going on now. And can you talk about what you're going to be talking about at Contact in the Desert and how people can contact you if they need more information on what we talked about today?
Sure, absolutely. So first things first, the landscape of disclosure. Well, those of us that have been in this space for a long time have been watching it sort of, you know, slowly leak out more and more, you know, from the guys on Larry King talking about ships shutting down nuclear weapons systems, to the, you know, next little step here, next little step there, a little bit of Pentagon move. But where we're at now is extremely fascinating, because now we have, you know, as of last year, the Pentagon clearly stating publicly to the New York Times that we believe these are off-world vehicles. That's a huge one, right? Because that's not just saying, oh, these are unidentified objects, that we believe these are unidentified objects, not from Earth. That's a huge leap, right? And then we've got the sort of current situation where we've got comments on a COVID bill, you know, that are potentially going to give pressure to the Pentagon and others to release more information. Now, you know, whether the Pentagon's going to go along with a comment that's written into a giant bill and say, oh yeah, that's twisting my arm enough, we're going to reveal more stuff, we'll see. Either way, there certainly is a lot of collective pressure for that release to happen. And I think that people are more ready than they've ever been to receive this information. It's not going to create a massive shock, you know, through the field. For the most part, everybody is like, yeah, yeah, we know. Like, of course, there's extraterrestrial beings out there. You know, there's got to be. It just makes sense scientifically. It just makes sense with how many stars there are in the galaxy, you know, or just curious. Like, wow, if there is, I'd love to know about it. Because I wish Star Trek was real. I'd love to get on a ship and go travel, you know, around the galaxy. And maybe they have some technology that could help us through some of our challenges. I think we're primed. We're primed for disclosure in a really big way. We're primed for the sort of next stage and next phase. I only offer a note of caution to anyone that's in that space exploring around it, because it was very, very clear in the early days of the Disclosure Project, when a woman came forward who was the assistant of Wernher von Braun, Carol Rosen, I believe is her name.
Carol Rosen, yeah.
And she was talking with Wernher von Braun, and you know, he's in a hospital bed, or basically on his deathbed, and he's telling her about the sort of four stages of implementation of control that were in planning. And the third one was terrorism, right? And we definitely saw that one be utilized massively as a system for centralized control. And the fourth card that he said would play, that they would play would be the extraterrestrial card. And that meaning that they would point to the extraterrestrial contact or placement around this planet as a threat in order to justify space-based weapons that could target anywhere on the planet and be used for massive totalitarian control. And I think we're still a little bit at risk of ending up in that direction. A lot of the disclosure interests and the ways that I hear people framing things when I watch videos by certain individuals is very concerning to me, because it doesn't have a relationship in it. It's them, it's the aliens, it's the others, and we should be scared, and we should probably have some weapons and be ready to fight, right? And that's very dangerous. Even just using the word alien to describe other beings from other planets who are visiting this world is dangerous, because it says we're not willing to be in relationship with you. You're the other, you're that which we don't understand. And that's vastly different from the experience of contactees like myself, like hundreds of thousands of other people out there who have had communication relationships, called in starships, talked to beings, seen beings in the physical as I have, had communication with them, and they operate much more like elders looking at adolescents on a planet going, you guys are going to figure this out and it's going to be okay. And you're going to get through this era of being afraid of each other and blowing each other up. And the next space is where you start playing at a much higher level. You're stewards of your planet. You get to adventure to other star systems. You get to explore in entirely new ways. And you don't have to fight over space anymore. You don't have to fight over resources anymore. The universe is abundant. And there's a level of consciousness there that I see greatly lacking in a lot of the people working in the disclosure space. And it's that space of consciousness of where we could be, where our potential can be if we develop harmonious relationships with advanced species around this galaxy and actually step up and grow up a little bit and take responsibility for the Earth that we're on.
Beautiful. And Contact in the Desert, what are you doing there? What kind of lecture are you doing there? And where can people contact you?
Yeah, so for this Contact in the Desert, I'm going to kind of step it up from my universal harmonic matrix, unified harmonic matrix work that I did there previously that people can watch on YouTube. It's available and open. And I highly recommend people check it out before this Contact in the Desert, because I'm going to go from there to ancient future technology and physics. So I'm going to talk about the unified science of starships, energy, and consciousness, looking at, you know, the encryptions of people like Leonardo da Vinci and Shakespeare and the magic and the pyramids and the pre-Diluvian civilizations, and tie that together with the future technology that we need to build starships and actually become part of this greater galactic civilization. So it's going to be fun. And then I'm going to do a couple deep dives on galactic species in very Contact in the Desert style. So it should be a really fun time.
That sounds okay. Wonderful. It sounds like a very rich talk. Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
So I'll send it back to Sinead, and she's the teacher. She'll give you a grade and tell you whether you passed the test today and close it out for us.
Sure thing. Sure thing. Adam, thank you so much for being here. I mean, honestly, this was a wonderful conversation. I think Grant and I were both nodding enthusiastically as you were speaking the whole way through. And, you know, it sounds like you're going to be giving a very content-rich, exciting talk that will help people expand their minds and perceptions about what's going on in this field even further, which is wonderful. So thank you so much for being here. Please come back sometime. This really feels like a much a deeper, longer conversation could occur if you've got any time for that. Hopefully we can have you back and have a longer conversation. But in the meantime, just thanks so much for your time and for being here. It was wonderful to meet you. And Grant, as always, thank you for having me, letting me do this with you. It's just the joy in my life. It really is. So thank you so much, Adam, for being here. And thank you, Grant.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Such a pleasure. And for those that want to find out more about me, you can just go to adamapollo.com. Or if you just Google my name, I show up in a lot of places. So that's a pretty easy way to find me.
Yeah, you have been in a lot of places. I'll give you that. I mean, you've been all over. Thanks.
Thanks, Grant.
Okay, I'm done here. Let's see.
Okay, I stopped recording. Adam, that was really
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.